Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing coverage of the election, abortion rights, and Elon Musk. First, abortion. The same electorate that voted for abortion rights in 7 out of 10 states, almost 8, we'll talk about that in a minute, also voted for Donald Trump and extreme anti-abortion Republicans. So what explains this? Today's guest, Amy Littlefield, is out with a new piece in The Nation called What We Learned from the Texas Town That Voted for Abortion and for Trump. She writes, abortion rights ballot initiatives won alongside the most conservative of Republicans, like Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri and Tim Sheehy in Montana. Even in Florida, the high-stakes abortion rights ballot initiative won 57% of the vote, making it 1 point more popular than Trump himself. It failed only because Florida has a 60% threshold for an amendment to pass, higher than almost any other state. The right to abortion won big this election, yet so did the party that ended that right. Amy Littlefield is the abortion access correspondent at The Nation and a freelance investigative reporter who focuses on the intersection of religion and healthcare. Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me back. And what a couple of weeks it's been.
Oh, what a couple of weeks. Well, we've had you on the show so many times over the years, Amy, just to talk about media coverage of abortion. And a big question people are asking is, you know, Kamala Harris made abortion one of the top issues of her campaign. So many people thought that because of extreme Republican abortion bans, people would come out in droves and vote for her because 80% of the population is pro-choice. In fact, the numbers have gone up since Roe was overturned. But that did not happen, Amy. How do you explain that?
And I'll be honest, Rose, that I was among the people who believed that it would happen, right? We have never seen a Democratic presidential candidate embrace abortion rights in the way that Kamala Harris did. And we know, as you say, that abortion rights are more popular than any politician out there, mm-hmm. right? They are extremely popular across the board. And so it is a complicated, and I think it will be a will take us a long time to unpack exactly what happened in this election. But I think one thing that is fundamentally clear is that when you run on abortion as a standalone issue, as these ballot campaigns did, right, they isolated abortion rights from the rest of the progressive agenda. When people, voters had a chance to vote in particular on the issue of abortion, they went for the pro-choice position. And yet many of them at the same time went for Republican candidates up and down the ballot and did not see a contradiction between those positions. I think there's a few things that explain this. And I'll tell you, you know, I spent Election Day in Amarillo, Texas, where I think this contradiction between voting Republican, you know, voting for the party that overturned the nationwide right to abortion and voting for abortion rights, this was the place where I think this contradiction was the starkest. There was an ordinance on the ballot in Amarillo that would have effectively banned people from traveling through the city to get an abortion out of state by using a private civil enforcement mechanism, empowering private citizens to sue anyone helping someone travel through the city. And it was on the ballot in Amarillo, and it was resoundingly defeated. 59% of voters defeated this anti-abortion ballot initiative. And yet the counties that encompass this city went for Trump, 72% and 80% in these two counties that overlap around Amarillo. And so I spent my day talking to voters, cornering people in the parking lot, trying to understand what the heck was on their minds as they voted for, you know, to uphold, you know, what limited abortion rights remain, of course, in a state where abortion is already illegal. And yet many of them, majority of them, voting for Donald Trump, the man who is almost single-handedly responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade.
You, like you say, you talked to a number of people who voted for abortion and for Trump. And you spoke with one woman, 60-year-old Dexie Organ, and I think this is a really, I think this says so much. You write, white women like Dexie Organ, a majority of whom voted for Trump, were willing to go along with Trump's racism and misogyny, in part because he had convinced them that his position on abortion was a moderate one. As for the Amarillo activist who managed to resoundingly defeat an anti-abortion initiative in the heart of Trump country, they won because they managed to convince voters that their cause was a conservative one. So there's a lot there. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah. So Dexie Organ was really fascinating. This is a woman who has 14 kids, 8 of them are daughters. And she told me that she felt like this anti-abortion ordinance that had been proposed to stop people from traveling through Amarillo to get an abortion elsewhere, she felt it was unconstitutional. And she wanted her daughters to have a choice, to be able to make their own decisions. She told me she'd had an abortion. And, you know, she said, we're women. I don't know why they think they need to suppress us. Right. So a pretty clear position in favor of abortion rights. But she also told me she wasn't worried about Trump, that she, like, you know, he had turned the abortion issue, in her words, back to the states, including her state of Texas, which had banned abortion. And she seemed to not feel that that posed the same threat to her daughters, right? And I think many women of color, you know, who are seeing Trump talk about mass deportation, you know, would of course view that threat differently. So I was really trying to understand that contradiction, and I think part of it lies in the messaging, right? I mean, the abortion rights activists who organized in Amarillo to defeat this ordinance understood the constituency they were dealing with, right? This is one of the most conservative areas in the country. This is a very anti-abortion area. And so what they decided to do is run essentially a conservative campaign. So their slogans said things like, say no to government overreach and defend our constitution. I had this surreal moment where I was looking at someone holding a sign that said, defend our constitution, vote against Prop A. That's the anti-abortion ordinance, was Prop A. And then I turned around and there was a white sheriff's SUV parked nearby that said Randall County Sheriff defending the Constitution. So it's like the messaging, the pro-choice messaging was so conservative that it was matching the motto used by local law enforcement, right? There was one door hanger that one of the activists told the New Yorker's Rachel Monroe about that said protect your rights with an eagle and a quotation from Governor Greg Abbott, who of course is against abortion, that said, if you want to start a fight with Texans, just try taking away their freedom. And what I found when I was talking to voters is that messaging was really resonating, right? It was really resonating with people who are saying we're Texans, you know, being a Texan is all about, you know, people not being in your business, and we don't want to create a bunch of snitches out there, and, you know, people should be able to travel if they want to travel. That government interference and decision-making messaging was really resonating, and it was resonating with people who then went and voted for Donald Trump. And so that's a contradiction and the risk there. And I want to say, I don't think this conservative messaging was unique to Amarillo. I actually think we saw resonances of that in these ballot campaigns for abortion rights across the country, in places like Florida, where the strategists who were trying to get the pro-choice amendment to protect abortion rights in Florida and to roll back that state 6-week ban, you know, they were trying to tap into outrage over quote-unquote government overreach during the COVID pandemic. Right. They were putting out internal guidance that told people not to attack Republicans like Ron DeSantis or Donald Trump, but to instead refer to extreme politicians. Well, it's not surprising, I don't think, that some voters took that as a permission slip to vote for abortion rights if they were, you know, in the vast majority of Americans who support those rights, and to also vote for Republicans.
Wow. So it's probably safe to assume that the people you interviewed who voted to protect abortion on the ballot in Texas voted for Donald Trump, and extreme Republicans in Texas who are anti-abortion.
Exactly. In a state where, you know, abortion is very illegal. I mean, a state with one of the harshest anti-abortion laws in the country, right? Of course, as a baseline.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking about the ProPublica report that we discussed a few weeks ago about Jocelyn Barnica, one of at least two pregnant women in Texas who died after doctors delayed emergency care. A woman died after being told it would be a, quote, crime to intervene in her miscarriage at a Texas hospital. So were you able to go a little deeper and talk to these people about all of this? Did you ask them about this extreme ban in Texas? Did you ask them where they get their information?
You know, this is why I will admit that I was wrong, you know, about the outcome of this election. I thought that these maternal deaths that were reported by ProPublica right before the election, you know, the tying of abortion bans in Georgia and in Texas to the deaths of people who were losing wanted pregnancies, I thought that was going to have a much more resounding impact in these states than it did. And I don't feel that I have an explanation yet for why these very clear and tragic cases of women who have died from these bans did not change the way that people were voting. I mean, I can tell you that Mark Lee Dixon, the anti-abortion activist that was behind this ordinance in Amarillo, you know, is adamant that it wasn't the laws that caused these deaths, that it's, you know, doctors and hospitals that are overinterpreting these laws or misinterpreting them. So, you know, people who buy into the anti-abortion position and support these laws will claim no responsibility for these deaths happening. And yet what's so remarkable about the ProPublica reporting is they were able to draw a pretty clear line, right, between these bans and the deaths of women. And that reporting happened so close to Election Day that I'm surprised it wasn't more at the front of people's minds.
To your point about people saying, well, Trump sent it back to the states. A number of networks like CNN, they've been going out to places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, and just asking people, why did you vote the way you did? And I've been struck by interviews with young women who said, I am pro-choice, but I voted for Trump because he sent the issue back to the states. And that's also kind of head spinning, Amy, because we've got extreme abortion bans in many states. I mean, the poor people in the South, because of what happened in Florida, and we'll talk about that in a minute, what are their, I mean, unless they can travel or they have access to pills, they have no options, the entire South. So can you talk about really, we have to say it, the brilliance of Donald Trump repeatedly saying, oh no, this is about the states. This is what the people have wanted. And then can you talk about media coverage of that, given that he repeated that constantly?
Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump managed to convince a good portion of this country that his decision to overturn 50 years of precedent on abortion, right, appointing the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, that that was somehow a moderate position. And what a public relations coup that was. I mean, I do think that the media's constant questioning of, you know, Trump and his associates over the idea of a nationwide abortion ban probably helped feed this narrative. You know, Trump insisted that he was not going to sign a nationwide abortion ban. And this was sort of a red herring because it's highly unlikely that Congress is going to pass a nationwide abortion ban. And we know that there's a backdoor option that anti-abortion strategists want Trump to use. And this was all written down in Project 2025. They want him to revive the 1873 anti-vice law, the Comstock Act, and use that to ban the mailing of abortion drugs nationwide. We know that he could use that law to attempt to institute basically a de facto nationwide abortion ban without a single law having to come across his desk for signature, right? Because Congress, again, is not going to pass such a thing. And so I think this fixation on a nationwide abortion ban and the idea that Trump said he would veto that nationwide abortion ban, which actually did make a lot of diehard anti-abortion activists angry, right? They were frustrated that he said he was going to veto that. But in the end, they came around because they understood that he was playing politics and this was all part of his strategy. And it worked. And And again, he was able to convince people that he, that somehow, and I think it helps, you know, Melania Trump comes out with this memoir saying that she supports the right to choose, which again, made some number of diehard anti-abortion activists angry, but not angry enough, it turns out, that they actually abandoned Donald Trump, the man who had given them the end of Roe v. Wade. And so he was able to thread this needle where he didn't totally alienate his base, and where he was able to convince enough people that his position, again, was not a threat to their daughters. And, you know, at the same time, I want to say, you know, having sat in on some focus groups, especially with white women ahead of the election, and just what I heard from voters in Amarillo, I think it's clear that abortion was just not the most important issue to most voters. A lot of them were very fixated on the economy. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, early on, I had said, you know, Kamala Harris, when she became the nominee, that she had a chance to weave together issues of economic freedom and the right to have childcare in this country, the right to have parental leave, the right to have things that so many people in other, you know, wealthy democracies around the world have, to weave together those core economic issues with a message of abortion rights and reproductive freedom. And she never really did that. I don't think she found an economic message that tied together, you know, that really resembled reproductive justice, that tied together abortion rights with other pocketbook issues facing people in their daily lives. And a lot of the folks that I talked to in Texas were talking about how they voted for Trump because they were financially struggling, or they felt like the economy wasn't doing well, and, you know, he was going to fix it. And for those for whom abortion was an important issue, you know, he had somehow convinced them he was not a threat.
Mm. One more question about the information, Amy, because this has been a theme in a lot of the shows we've been doing after the election. Just looking at how the media world has drastically changed, even in the past couple of years. I mean, it's interesting. YouTube is now where a lot of people go to get their information. It's surpassed a number of the podcast platforms. So now you've got 1 in 5 voters in battleground states thinking that Biden is responsible for ending the right to an abortion. The New York Times had this piece back in May. So again, head spinning. People think Biden did this. Did you ask people where they get their information?
No, I mean, that's a really great follow-up question that I didn't have time when I was bombarding people in the parking lot to ask them. But I think, you know, that's a really crucial issue, especially when we look at young people, and for young women in particular, for whom abortion was a really important issue. And so how do they understand who's responsible for their, you know, the dissolution of their rights? And where are young people getting their information? And that is often from social media, you know, from TikTok, from clips of politicians speaking and going for what's attention grabbing. And so we've entered a whole new era of misinformation. And unfortunately, I think Donald Trump was able to use that to his advantage and, you know, let himself off the hook for ending the very popular nationwide right to abortion, and yet still winning the presidency again.
Eileen has a question about information. Why do we think that? Where do we think people got this information? Was it on Facebook? This is the question that so many of us are asking, Eileen. What are your thoughts, Amy, just quickly, and then we'll move on to Florida and the South.
Where people are getting information about.
Yeah, just about abortion and just the, all of this misinformation. I mean, to think that Biden got rid of abortion, it's, you just wonder, where did you hear this?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, again, social media, you pointed out YouTube, you know, there's so much misinformation and disinformation floating around. But I do think we also, again, have to look at the media's culpability in sort of fixating on the idea of a nationwide abortion ban. And Trump's ability to sort of, oh, say, I'm going to veto that. And even to sort of confound voters by indicating at one point that maybe he was going to even vote for the abortion rights ballot initiative in Florida. I mean, I think he really tried his best to muddy the waters around his position on abortion and to sort of walk back his responsibility, at the same time as, you know, when he's would speaking to supporters, he would tout his, you know, reversal of Roe v. Wade, and they certainly loved him and did not forget him for it.
Today, we are speaking with Amy Littlefield. Amy has a new piece out in The Nation called What We Learned from the Texas Town That Voted for Abortion and for Trump. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation and a freelance investigative reporter. We've got about 5 more minutes with Amy. And again, I'm sorry, but we've got some problems with our phone lines. You can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about what happened in Florida, Amy, because we say that 7 out of 10 states voted for abortion rights, but really it's 8. The problem is that in Florida, you need 60% to pass a measure, and this one got 57. As you point out, this was 1 point more popular than Donald Trump in Florida. This is devastating, because when you look at the South, this is where most of the extreme abortion bans are. So what are your thoughts about what this means going forward for, you know, people living in these states? What options do they have?
Yeah, I mean, Florida is the state I was watching most closely because it is a funnel into which abortion patients from across the South were flowing before Florida's 6-week ban took effect in May. And that basically cut off this key destination for abortion access in the South and forced people further afield, and also created this situation where, you know, there were more than 80,000 abortions that had happened in Florida. So all these Florida abortion patients were now flocking further to the North, to clinics further afield, or some of them, you know, accessing places like Aid Access and ordering abortion pills online if they knew how to do that. You know, I went to Florida in the summer and watched the terrible sorting process that happens when people go into the clinic and wait and hold their breath and have an ultrasound and see whether they're scanning under the state's 6-week limit or whether they might be just a day or two past it and therefore too late. I watched people come out crying when they were, you know, just measuring a couple millimeters too big on that ultrasound. I watched people come out, you know, breathing sighs of relief when they had just made it. And we're seeing this scene play out every single day in this absolutely enormous state that was a key destination in the South. I mean, this was a huge effort. Over $100 million was poured into the ballot initiative in Florida. Mm-hmm. And as you point out, it very nearly passed, right? 57% of the vote, more popular than Trump. There's all this talk about how well Trump did in Florida and how red the state is. Well, abortion rights did very well there too. It's just that the state has this unusual 60% threshold. So in almost every other state in the country, of course, that would have passed, but it just barely failed. And the impact of that for abortion access across the South is simply devastating.
Mm. I just keep thinking about the women and the girls who cannot afford to travel, who don't have access to the pills, and who are in abusive relationships and don't have a way out, or who, you know, sorry, I mean, anytime we talk about abortion, I always need to put a disclaimer that we're going to talk about things that are, you know, difficult. Some people might not want to hear all of this for various reasons, but rape and incest? I mean, I just keep thinking about that. How many young people, women, but I think about girls who are in abusive households and have no options. When do you think that we're going to get more data on that and more stories about that?
I mean, and of course, we had the story about the 10-year-old girl in Ohio, right?
Right.
And that became national news. And that was one story that became a huge national story. And yet we know when we hear from providers, when we hear from people on the ground, that she is far from alone in being, you know, a victim who ends up being, you know, doubly traumatized by these laws, either forced to travel or forced to remain pregnant. And I know there were some voters, because I sat in focus groups with them, you know, moderate white women in swing states in the Midwest who had been really impacted by stories like these, you know, for whom abortion rights was top of mind in sort of alienating them from the Republican Party. I think the question we are going to be reckoning with probably for years is why that was not enough, is how abortion rights and Republican candidates managed to both win big in the same election. And despite all of these heartbreaking stories we've been hearing for some time.
We have an email from Cornelius who writes, "Perhaps because I am a 70-year-old black man who lived during the time of Southern Jim Crow segregation, would it not be useful to remind people what leaving legislation to the states has meant?" Thank you, Cornelius. This is such an important comment that really deserved so much more attention, Amy, when Trump constantly focused on sending this back to the states.
Absolutely. That is such an important reminder. And, you know, I will say, I think the idea of states' rights, of course, has been a longstanding, you know, right-wing Confederate, you know, pro-slavery in that era position. And in more recent years, it has been a really challenging position for progressives, or a position that progressives have often avoided. Progressives have not always fought for the states, whereas conservatives, I think, have really dominated in the area of state legislatures and state-based policies, right? And so turning these issues back to the states not only means deep, profound inequality in the very states that have the highest, you know, levels of maternal mortality, in the very states that tend to lack in supports for families, that tend to have high levels of poverty. It not only means profound, you know, racial and economic inequality, as Cornelius is pointing out, it's also an arena where progressives have not built up their ability to fight in the same way that conservatives have over the years, because, you know, states' rights has been much more naturally a conservative position over the years. And so, you know, I think this was a weakness for abortion rights activists that they're beginning to reverse now by fighting for some of these ballot initiatives, for example. But they just do not have the power locally and in the states that conservatives do, especially in a lot of these southern states.
Just quickly, Amy, before we let you go, Republicans now have the White House, the Senate, and the House. How far do you think they will go on abortion? And what are you hearing from pro-choice activists about the way forward?
I mean, you know, the selection of RFK Jr. as HHS secretary, if that nomination goes through, I think is a very strange and uncomfortable one for the anti-abortion movement, frankly, because a lot of what the Trump administration can do, especially in the early days, is going to come through the FDA and the Department of Health and Human Services, right? Things like using the 1873 Comstock Act to, you know, institute a nationwide ban on mailing of abortion drugs. I mean, right now, organizations like Aid Access that are mailing medication abortion, the most popular form of abortion nationwide, they're a key lifeline for people in states like Texas and Florida, because even in these red states, you can order medication abortion from medical professionals and have it shipped to your doorstep from someone who's within the United States. Now, that could go away under the Trump administration. But, you know, RFK Jr. is being condemned by the likes of Mike Pence, for example, for, you know, being essentially pro-choice. And so I think it remains to be seen what other appointments we see within HHS to understand exactly how far they're going to go with regulations. But, you know, I don't see why they wouldn't fulfill the promise of the anti-abortion movement and of white evangelicals who have helped form a core of Trump's base all along, and go as far as they can toward, you know, banning abortion and restricting the mailing of abortion medication, even in the very states that voted to protect abortion rights this election.
Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent for The Nation. She spent some time in Amarillo, Texas, talking to people who voted for the abortion rights measure and also voted for extreme anti-abortion Republicans, including Donald Trump. You can find her piece at KALW.org. Click news and then your call. Amy, thank you so much, as always, for your great reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about how Elon Musk, the world's richest person, will benefit from Donald Trump's victory. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.